Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Are you tired of the same old fantasy football leagues that you hear about online that get canceled after a year or so? If so, Dynasty Owner has your back. Dynasty Owner unites the fun and excitement of fantasy football with the skill and strategy of the front office by incorporating a salary cap and real NFL player salaries for diehard fantasy football fanatics that want the real GM experience. You can finally take all the knowledge you've learned about on the pod and put it to use in actual fantasy football. It adds a whole new level of strategy to fantasy football. They think it's such a big difference maker that they hold three patents on it. So what are you waiting for? Go to dynastyowner.com. New leagues for the 2021 season are forming now. That's dynastyowner.com. You know, so if you're worried about you won't be able to find anyone to play with in your league, don't worry. Dynasty Owner can help you fill your league with fantasy football enthusiasts like yourself, so you won't have to worry about finding enough players. You can choose to start your own league, join a league that needs to be filled, or you can even purchase a team from a previous owner if you'd like to take that team to the championship. If you're finally serious about joining the big leagues, go to dynastyowner.com and start your dynasty today. That's dynastyowner.com. I'm telling you guys, you are going to absolutely love it. What is happening, gang? We are live on the Inside Football Podcast with Bill Polian, and we are jacked about this week's episode to dive into our look at the Hall of Fame. So this is that kind of fun window in the NFL calendar where the season is just on the other side of that hill, and the Hall of Fame is upon us. And we get to look at some of the historic performances players have put up throughout the history of the league. And in this episode, we get to Bill's insight into how the Hall of Fame was created, what its relationship with the NFL is, how players get in, what the selection process is, and what is the criteria that guys look at when they're evaluating players for the NFL. So this is truly a unique opportunity to kind of get into the mind of not just an NFL Hall of Fame GM, not just a Hall of Famer, but someone who's actually on the selection committee to understand how all of this works. This is truly a fun show for anybody that's interested in this kind of stuff. But before we dive in, I want to take a minute and talk about one of our favorite sponsors on the show, BetOnline. July is underway and a great month for sports. I know that the NBA Finals is behind us, but MLB is heading into the second half of the season, and there's betting action to get involved with. If you're a football bettor, there's tons of future and prop bets that you can start doing on BetOnline today. They've got NFL MVP prop bets. I'm looking at a sheet right now. You can get Aaron Rodgers at plus 1600, last year's NFL MVP at plus 1600. I have a hunch he's going to be playing next year. I have a hunch he's going to be playing in Green Bay, but that remains to be seen. Might be a fun bet. Not giving advice, just maybe making a suggestion. So what are you waiting for? Head over to BetOnline now and visit the website or use your mobile device to join and receive your 50% off welcome bonus on your first deposit. That's right, 50% off welcome bonus on your first deposit. So before the next tip-off, face-off, or pitch, or you want to do some futures betting, head over to BetOnline and start playing today. All right, gang, this is our look at the process for the NFL Hall of Fame, how it came together, and all the permutations therein on the Inside Football Podcast with Bill Polian. Yeah. And we are live on the Inside Football Podcast with Bill Polian. And today it is you can feel it in the air. I can feel it almost in my bones. Preseason will be upon us. Training camp starts in Richmond next week for the football team's campaign to the Super Bowl. Everything is happening. And so to that end, we're going to spend the next couple of weeks talking a little bit about the Hall of Fame. And so in this first episode, we're going to talk a little bit about the mechanics of the hall, how it was created, how you get into the hall, who picks, a lot of those elements. So without further ado, Rick, why don't you jump us into it?
Okay, great. You get that precursor to one of your favorite times of year, Scott, the preseason. The Hall of Fame season always comes right before it. So you're getting closer to the edge of your chair.
You're there.
Okay. All right. So, you know, the hall was founded in 63. Bill, historically, why Canton?
Well, because Canton is the spiritual and now with a lot of research done, the actual birthplace of the National Football League. Ralph Hay, prior to 1920, there was a loose amalgamation of professional football teams who were really vagabonds. They played in small towns in the East and the Midwest. Collegiate players masqueraded and played on Sunday as pros. That's why the pros played on Sunday originally.
Right.
And those guys played under assumed names and were paid for their efforts. And then on Monday went back to class and played where, and the following Saturday played wherever they were going to school. It was a loose amalgamation. Schedules were made much as Sandlot teams do today on an ad hoc basis. And there was never a declared national champion. And there was no real league structure. And teams came and went. The Portsmouth Spartans, the Pottsville Maroons, they sort of materialized, had a run and then ran out of money or couldn't function very well. So it was, it was generally looked down upon. Pro football players were looked down upon as vagabonds and ne'er-do-wells, people who didn't want to work for a living. They just continued to just play sports that they should have ended when they left college.
Changed a little bit now. Just a smidge.
Slightly, yeah.
A little.
And one of the people that joined with Ralph Hay, was a car dealer in Canton, Ohio, and he was acting as a sort of a pseudo commissioner, trying to bring together some of the franchises. And he had a Hupmobile dealership in Canton, Ohio, in downtown Canton. It's actually commemorated with a plaque on the wall of the building and sort of in the center city. And in his showroom, he convened a meeting of many of the entrepreneurs and coaches and general managers who, in most cases, they were one and the same, who ran these franchises throughout the Midwest and the East. And so one of the attendees at that meeting was George Halas, who was then the general manager, head coach, organizer, and chief cook and bottle washer for the Decatur Staleys another vagabond football team located in Decatur, Illinois, and representing the Staley Starch Company. It was a company team. In those days, by the way, many companies sponsored football and baseball teams as part of not a health and wellness, but an employee benefit position. So they got together and they essentially formed the National Football League. And instead of Ralph Hay being the first commissioner, they appointed a man named Joe Carr. But Halas was the driving force behind it. And then soon thereafter, the Staley Starch Company said to Halas, here, you take the team. We'll give it to you, lock, stock, and barrel. He did, moved it to Chicago, and it became the Chicago Bears.
Yeah.
In 1925, the National Football League convinced a guy who was essentially a bookmaker. It was legal at the time, but there was no parimutuel betting, so there were people at the racetracks in New York and around the country who set odds and took bets. That man's name was Tim Mara. And for $25,000, he bought a franchise in New York, which became the New York Football Giants. They're still known as that today, legally.
Yeah.
The Pottsville, Pennsylvania Maroons eventually became the Philadelphia Eagles. In 1933, I believe, a professional gambler and saloon owner named Art Rooney Sr. Won a lot of money on a race at Saratoga in New York, and took some of those winnings and founded a football team called the Pittsburgh Steelers. So the genesis of it all was in Ralph Hayes' Huckmobile showroom in Canton, Ohio. So that's why the hall is in Canton.
Right. And then I think a couple of things that they'll write. They were originally called the American Football, Professional Football Association, right? And then the NFL came along a little later. And also Canton has its own claim to fame that I think they were the first two-time champs in the NFL.
Yes, the Canton Bulldogs. That's correct. Yes. Yeah.
And then, of course, there was a more prosaic reason that it happened, which was that the Canton community got together the year before and raised $400,000, which in today's dollars is like $3.5 million, and built the first building there. So it wasn't like there were a lot of people stepping up to do this.
No, and at that time, there was a tradition of small towns which had sometimes even an ephemeral a connection to the founding of the sport, i.e. Cooperstown, New York, Springfield, right. Massachusetts,
right.
Being the home of the original home of the sport, right. And therefore the Hall of Fame.
One other jumping ahead, you know, we always heard from the days on of Pete Rozelle being the most powerful man in sports. Well, in terms of sports executives, David Baker certainly has to be the biggest
executive. Well, for those that have not seen David, he's about 6'8", and since he's lost a tremendous amount of weight, he's under 300 pounds, but he is a big man, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I think more ways than one.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think there were times when he must have tipped those scales over 400, but and I first encountered him, Bill, when he was the commissioner of the Arena Football League, and he saved my client from being suspended for inadvertently digesting some spaghetti, which was laced with what he thought was oregano. Oh, but it turned out to be marijuana. But Dave came through for me and we got to play on. So he's a very good guy, a wonderfully enthusiastic salesman of the league and of the hall. He really, and really, you know, where the halls came, Bill, from that first little building to where it is now is amazing.
Oh, yeah, and he's the driving force behind all of that. He's very entrepreneurial. He's very optimistic. He's done a marvelous job of expanding the footprint of the Hall of Fame, the centerpiece of which is Tom Benson Stadium, which is used to be Canton Municipal Stadium, at the home of Canton McKinley High School, which is a legendary high school football power in the state of Ohio. The Canton-Massillon high school rivalry dates back a long, long way, and one of the people who made it famous was the winningest coach of all time at Massillon High School, none other than Paul Brown. Mm-hmm. So there are deep roots for football in the state of Ohio, and Canton's at the heart of it. But the new stadium is an amazing place.
Yes. We're just about to move on to some real more player kind of specific questions. But I had to say this, Bill, when you were inducted you know, we had so much fun. But the volunteers there are the nicest, most forthcoming volunteers of any event I've ever been in my life. They were just terrific, those the people.
They are, and they really accept and embrace the mission of the hall, and they embrace Hall of Famers. The saying that they have is, when you come back every year as a Hall of Fame member or however many times you come back for ceremonies and what have you, they always say, "Welcome home. This is your second home," mm-hmm. and they treat you that way.
Yeah.
And for example, the gentleman that drove me and my wife and my family during the weekend when I was enshrined, I see him every year. We get together, we exchange Christmas cards, we talk about the families. It's a marvelous relationship. Yes,
it really is. All right. Well, as of 2021, there are 364 gold jackets. Bill, who is actually eligible to be honored as inducted into the hall?
Well, as a player, there's a number of different categories. As a player, you must be retired for 5 years before you're eligible. And then you stay eligible, I believe, for 20 years. After that, 10 years. After that, you go
10 years after the five?
Yes, 10 years after the five.
Yeah, right. It starts in the sixth.
Retired for five, you become eligible, and then your eligibility for direct membership runs for 10 years. Mm-hmm. For coaches, it is literally at any time. So Joe Gibbs retired after coaching the Redskins and then was eligible upon his retirement to be elected. And then he decided to go back and coach the Redskins a second time. That was fine. No issue there whatsoever.
We liked it. It was good. We were fans.
The only prohibition for coaches is that they cannot be eligible when they're actively coaching. So Bill Belichick, who will be a first ballot, first minute selectee, is not eligible because he's still coaching. For executives, they are eligible at any time. And then executives can be elected as part of the general population, if you will. Although it's a little different now. There is and I was the first, along with Ron Wolf, the first beneficiary of this. There was a new category created, which has to be voted upon by the board of directors of the hall, by the way, called the contributor category. And the reason that was done was because there's a number, you can only enshrine 8 people in a given year. This year's an exception because we had the 100th anniversary centennial class and we had no inductions last year because of COVID. So we'll talk about that at a later stage.
Yes, yes.
But in normal circumstances, you can only enshrine 8 in a given year. And you ask why? The answer is that's all a television show can accommodate.
Hey.
So,
but now that they're going with a faster pace, do you think we'll get more?
I doubt it.
Okay.
I doubt it. So that would be 5 players, a senior nominee, and 2 contributors. Senior nominees are people who have aged out of the regular rotation, but can have a second bite of the apple. And for the next 4 years, there will be on in even years, there will be 1 senior nominee and 2 contributors. And in, next 4 years, there will be 1 senior nominee and 1 contributor nominee each year. And they'll get revisited again after 4 years. The categories won't go away, and senior nominees will never go away.
Right.
So they get a second bite of the apple. and it's needed, by the way. It's needed.
Mm-hmm.
So Those owners are the three.
And then owners, Bill, right? Owners.
Owners are eligible straight up, but now they're essentially included in the contributor committee, in the contributor category. And, you know, that's a bit of a conundrum, but, you know, that's where they are. So you don't, the contributor committee was not intended to be a place where you put owners in the hall. It was intended to honor people who were not players and not coaches who contributed greatly to the game throughout their careers. Now, some owners qualify for that, but certainly not all.
Right.
And so, you know, that's the conundrum. But in any event, those are the categories. Regular admission after 5 years as players, coaches eligible at any time, as long as they're not coaching, and then contributors and seniors. And that makes up the eight-person roster that you will see in normal years.
Mm-hmm.
And then that process, there's a special voting process for each of those categories. Ultimately, everybody has to receive 80% of the vote from the group of selectors. There are 42 selectors. The seniors and the contributors are voted upon by separate subcommittees. And in the history of those nominations by subcommittees, only one has ever failed. Mm-hmm. It's generally a rubber stamp.
So you mentioned the special class, the centennial slate, that was going, and it's going to include, you were very involved in that. Tell us the genesis of that, how it worked. And I know you have some fascinating insights and stories about actually participating in the progress. We'd love to have you share.
Well, the centennial class was the brainchild of a number of people, including David Baker, Joe Horrigan, who was the executive vice president of the hall and who ran the day-to-day operation of the hall and the entire selection process for as long as I can remember, was the driving force behind this. And he got a number of people around the league interested in pushing this. Let me backtrack a little bit and explain the relationship between the National Football League and the Hall of Fame. It is arm's length, to say the least. There are owners, and right now I think there are two who serve on the board of directors, but the board is overwhelmingly civilian, so to speak, not NFL oriented. And then the NFL every year obviously sends and pays the expenses of the teams who play in the Hall of Fame game. And they give a stipend every year to the Hall of Fame, but it is not enough, not even nearly enough, to operate the hall. I think if you, and there's no one alive who can remember this any longer to check on it, but I think the original stipend was designed to run the hall. But that you know, faded quickly, and actually the David Baker and his staff make a presentation to the ownership every year at the March meeting, the annual meeting of the league, to ask for funds, and they don't get it very often. The stipend is raised, you know, inflationarily, every couple of years, but nothing special.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know, honestly. I don't know, honestly. I really don't. I've never asked that question. It just is.
Right. Because anybody who's been to Canton as a fan, it's like the Field of Dreams moment.
Oh, it is. It is.
It's the cradle of football. They have unbelievable exhibits. It's an unbelievably fun way to spend a day. You would think the league would want to do everything in their capacity to financially support it.
Yeah, well, they don't. they expect it to be at least in large measure self-supporting.
Right.
And David has taken that approach. I mean, he's taken an entrepreneurial approach because that's the only way to expand and grow the hall. So that said, There is a group of selectors who are chosen by the Hall Board and who are chosen within the guidelines selected with the constitution and bylaws of the Hall within the those guidelines. And this goes back to the founding of the Hall. They are to be media members, as is the Baseball Writers Association with baseball. And they must be working media members. So in recent years, there was a push from the football community, i.e. Hall of Famers, players and coaches in the league, to include some Hall of Famers on the selection committee for a couple of reasons. Number one, institutional knowledge. As the media people get younger, they haven't seen a lot of the people that are being nominated, and secondly, as they grow farther and farther from the field because of the nature of media and the nature of the bigness of the National Football League and most recently, of course, COVID, where everything was done virtually. There's a need to have the expertise of people who've actually been on the ground and played against these guys and coached against them and managed against them to be part of that process. So there are now four gold jackets on the selection committee, of which I am one. The other three are Dan Fouts, Tony Dungy, and James Lofton. So
almost a nomination.
I'm clearly the junior member of that group. But
yeah,
but it's fun. It's a fun process. It's very different than anything I was used to before. But that's how the enshrinees are selected.
Hey, Bill.
Anyone can be nominated. Excuse me. Go ahead.
Sorry. Hey, Bill, how do the reporters get picked? Because like, even in looking at the reporters, like I found it weird, some of the reporters that were even there, just in terms of it's not necessarily all the name guys you would think of who cover individual teams.
No, there's a requirement that each market be represented by a media member. So each of the 32 markets have a quote voter on the committee.
Right.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry. Who picks those? Like, how does like
who picks those?
Like, say, Garrett Bell becomes the one for us.
It goes through originally Joe Horgan, now Salim Chowdhury, whose title is director of the selection process.
Okay.
And he consults with senior selectors. He consults with David Baker. He consults with people at the league. And he consults with the Pro Football Writers Association, who has a loud voice in nominating selectors. Mm-hmm. And then the people are chosen from there. Now, there are people who are sort of grandfathered in, who've been around a while and maybe are no longer meet all the qualifications, but they stay.
Right.
And so... You know, there's a calling every once in a while, but it's once in a while.
Yeah. Yeah. if at any point in time a city has two franchises, they get two. Actually,
that's correct. It's per franchise. One voter per franchise plus 10 so-called at-large. 32 plus 10 so-called at-large. The four gold jackets are part of the at-large contingent. And then, you know, that at-large group is designed to accommodate. I'm going to pick a name. He's not a voter, as far as I know, but Chris Berman, for example, from ESPN. There's no way to include. They don't have a franchise, but Fox Sports, NBC Sports, all have people who should be voters, but you know, don't have a franchise. John Zarnecki was a well-known sports writer who's now with Fox, is one of those people. So there are 10 at-large spots in addition to the 32 selectors representing each market.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So talk about the difference, in a sense, between football and baseball now. And no, even on the baseball side of these things, these are actually not rules. But Bill, you and I, and Scott knows, you and I have just been around a little longer to know this. You know, in making decisions in baseball, there are certain benchmarks that everybody knows that kind of qualify you, like 3,000 hits and 500 homers or 300 wins. In football, are there, when you, the selectors, are looking to approve somebody, you know, are there things like that in football, or is that not kind of how you go about it?
There are general, first of all, these are not hard and fast rules. They're right. Traditions.
Right, right.
And there are general standards which people refer to. So, for example, let me just get my stats here for a moment. Oh, good God. Did you hear the jackhammer? That's not coming from my yard. Is there any way to block this out, or do we need to change rooms?
No, we can get it out in the edit.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Yes.
For example, for certain positions like receivers, you know, receptions, receiving yards would be a statistic that everyone relies upon. And the all-time ranking is really important in any of these categories. For quarterbacks, obviously, it would be touchdown passes. It would be yards, quarterbacks. It would be QBR, passing, total passing yards. For all skilled players, touchdowns scored. For defensive backs, interceptions is a big statistic. For defensive linemen and linebackers, sacks are a big statistic. So all of those are parts of the discussion. And so, for example, with receivers, in receiving yards, here are the top 10. Jerry Rice, Larry Fitzgerald, who is not with a team now and may not play again this year, but his five-year clock doesn't start, by the way, until he officially retires.
Right.
Terrell Owens and Randy Moss, who are third and fourth respectively in receiving yards. Terrell Owens was a very, very a controversial selection, but ultimately made it. Isaac Bruce, Tony Gonzalez, Tim Brown, Steve Smith, who he will be eligible, I believe, next year.
Yep.
Marvin Harrison and Reggie Wayne, who was a finalist last year but did not make it. Those are the top 10 guys in receiving as of now. Andre Johnson is next. He's won't be eligible for a couple more years, I don't think. James Lofton, Chris Carter, Torrey Holt, Andre Reed, Steve Largent, et cetera. So Art Monk. So when you go down that list, virtually everybody in the top 10 is a significant, is either in or will be, and others, you know, are probably pretty close to being inducted when they become eligible. Rushing yards, for example, Emmitt Smith, Walter Payton, Frank Gore still playing, Barry Sanders, Adrian Peterson still playing, Curtis Martin, LaDainian Tomlinson, Jerome Bettis, Eric Dickerson, Tony Dorsett, Jim Brown, Marshall Faulk, Edgerrin James, Marcus Allen, Franco Harris, Thurman Thomas, and then it stops there, but that's a total of, let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. That's well over 20 guys who are in based on their rushing yards. And the magic number is 12,000 rushing yards.
Right.
For career.
So, hey, Bill, looking at the rush yards, for example, if you look at the top 15, probably ostensibly, obviously, Adrian Peterson's still playing. He'll likely be a Hall of Famer. How hard do you think the conversation will be, or will it be hard for a player like Frank Gore, who has 16,000 total yards rushing in his career, but maybe people don't think of him as a Hall of Fame running back?
Well, now you get into what is a very subjective selection process.
Yeah.
But like every other group of people in the world, there are elder statesmen in the group who, generally speaking, sort of shepherd the discussion and shepherd the discussion offline as well. So one of the things that the elder statesmen have talked about for long periods of time is that longevity is important, because in a sport where the average guy plays, the average person who makes a team and plays 2 years plays six, when you get a person who's played 16 years, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And when he's done it in a way that is productive, that's even more amazing.
Right.
So I would think that Gore may not be a first ballot nominee. No one knows what qualifies a first ballot nominee. There's a big argument about it, there's a big discussion about it. But, I think for sure, as the third leading ground gainer of all time, he would get my vote. Let me put it that way.
Right.
Adrian Peterson is a bit dicier because the back end of his career has been non-existent virtually. I mean, he's been on a team, but he's not been productive. So what you're going to do with him is look at his most productive years. And let me talk a little more about the selection process, because this is unique.
Yep.
Let's go back to that media member who's selected from each market. They act as the advocate in the meeting for the nominee. So if you are from a market, if your guy is from a market where the advocate is highly respected in the room, and more importantly, if he or she is a good advocate, a good lawyer, a person who can make a good argument and refute counter arguments, you got a better chance than if your advocate is not.
Right.
Terrific. So it helps to have a good lawyer. There's no question about that.
So, Bill.
Well, that's true in life generally, Bill, wouldn't
generally.
You say?
Sadly, I hate to agree, but it's true.
So, Bill, can you take us into the room? So you get the list of players, then I'm assuming how long are the sort of presenters allowed to advocate for the player? Do they get like a 10-minute presentation, 15-minute presentation, and then there's discussion afterwards? How does that work?
Well, let's go back to the process so you understand.
Yeah.
The step-by-step process.
Right.
Anybody who's eligible can be nominated. And you, Rick, or you, Scott, could nominate somebody by, as long as they're eligible, by sending their name to the Hall of Fame.
Okay.
That name is curated to make sure that they are eligible. And then some standards are applied. So if you nominated a guy who played a year, for example, you know, he wouldn't make the list.
Right.
But virtually anybody who's played for 5 years and had a, you know, some honor at some point, Pro Bowl or something like that in his career, or has been a long time star, will make the nominee list.
Mm-hmm.
That is then circulated to the selectors. And beginning quite soon in August, after the enshrinement, we'll get the original list. And we will narrow that list, I believe, to 25 semifinalists. And then that's by vote and majority vote. And then in the case of 25, that's a plurality, obviously. And then to 15. And then, and once you reach 15, those are the original, those are called finalists. And then in the meeting, which is the day before the Super Bowl, those 15 individuals are discussed. And then you vote from 15 to 10, and then from 10 to 5, which are the number of people who are selected from the player category. The respective senior and contributor category committees make their recommendations, their final recommendations, and then those people get an up or down 80% vote. So that's how the process works. So okay. Now,
yeah. To say, take us in the room now, you know, and tell us about the tone of the discussion, the quality. If somebody's advocating, would there be a guy that says, you know, that guy's a jerk, or he does, you know, he really didn't do what you think he did, because like yada yada yada.
Before we meet, the hall staff sends out a book that is hundreds of pages thick, which contains biographical detail and statistical detail on every nominee. And you are free as a selector to do anything you wish with that. I go through extensive statistical comparisons between people. So, length of career, average gain per pass attempt. You know, I take out a yellow legal pad and write down all the nominees by position and try and do a pretty in-depth statistical comparison of them all before I ever apply the eye test or what I know of the nominee from his pure playing ability, to try to get as much hard data as I can. I think most selectors do that. They're certainly during the discussions, there's certainly evidence of that. Last year was my first year as a selector. I'd been a consultant to both the senior committee and the contributor committee. By the way, I forgot to mention, there's now a separate coaches category. This year would be the first year to be voted upon. I'm sorry, didn't mention that in the first instance. That's how you get to 8. So now it's players, senior nominee, so chosen by subcommittee. By the way, the committees are all selectors. Coaches nominee, chosen by a subcommittee and nominated by a subcommittee, and contributor nominated by a subcommittee. So that's how you get to 8. And 3 of those are nominated by subcommittees of the selectors. I'm on the senior committee this year, as well as being an overall selector. So with that said, back inside the room, I think there's probably 3 categories of people that you discuss. The first would be the obvious first ballot person.
Right.
And, And this year it was Peyton Manning and Mike Chappell, who from the Indianapolis, formerly the Indianapolis Star, he's with a television station now, stood up and said, Peyton Manning, any questions? And many people believe that that is the only way someone should make it on the first ballot. There are, now, not this is not cut and dried. Many people I've talked to, fellow selectors, believe that's the criteria for a first ballot guy. It's not written in stone. There's no rule that says that's the case. But obviously, when Tom Brady's name is mentioned, any questions?
Yeah.
You know?
Right, yeah.
Bill Belichick, any questions?
Right.
You know, there won't be. Right. So that's one criteria or one category of people, of person. Megatron made it on the first ballot this year, but not without discussion. And the fact and the discussion was not around whether he belonged in the Hall of Fame or was going to make it. It was what, you know, should he be on the first ballot? It was short-lived, by the way.
Bill, to that end, how hard is it when you're comparing him to, say, like a Reggie Wayne who has more career yards?
Well, length of career and yards per catch are, you know, are things that you can use to sort of parse that out to get to the point where it's, and I do that, by the way, to get to the point where it's where you have an accurate comparison. And then the third category is the guy around which there's going to be some discussion. And those can, you know, in my experience, they're all very civil, but there are people who feel strongly about candidates, and there are people who feel just as strongly that they don't belong. Those I've never called them marginal, because everybody that makes it to the final 15 is probably going to make it to the Hall of Fame at some point in time, and probably should. But there are guys that around which there's discussion, and there's a lot of discussion. And as you might imagine, some people agree and some people don't. And it's tough to get 80%. That's a really high standard. The baseball Hall of Fame is 75%, by
right.
the way.
Yeah.
This is 80% is a hard standard to meet. Right. So you have to have both a great record, and as I said before, it helps to have great advocates for you in the room. And it's not just your advocate that speaks. He gets 5 minutes, but then the open discussion can go as long as you know they want it to go, in mm-hmm. essence.
And when somebody, if it's not a and forgive the mixed sport metaphor, but if it's not a slam dunk candidate like Peyton Manning, when folks are standing up arguing against them, are they just using statistical things, or are they saying, oh, he was just a product of the system, or, you know, how are they mounting these challenges, Bill?
Well, they, you know, keep in mind, I've only been in there once.
Right.
So I can only give you a snapshot. It can range from, you know, he didn't have very good games against another Hall of Famer, to his career is too short.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to Terrell Owens' selection, I'm sorry, the running back from Denver, Terrell Davis, prior to his selection, there appeared to be, if you just analyzed it, a bias toward people who had long careers and a bias against people who had short careers. Gale Sayers was really the only exception. But then once Davis got in, then, you know, like things in Congress and things in the law, once that sort of rubric was was changed,
right?
Now the argument for Tony Boselli is stronger. He only had really 6 years. His career was shortened by injury, sadly. But once Terrell Davis got in, then people said, well, why not Tony Boselli?
Right. There's a matter of precedent. You can set a precedent in that way.
That's exactly right. The precedent that short careers were disqualifying seems to have been ameliorated a bit. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how that goes going forward. A lot depends on who's in the class. John Clayton, a good friend of mine who's been a selector for a long time, explained it to me. He helped orient me toward the selection process so that I would, you know, I didn't go in the room blind. And he said, you know, a lot of it depends on who's in the class, who's eligible in a given year. You might have a given year with 15 finalists, 12 of whom would make it in any other year, you know? So, and you might have a year where of 15, there were only 3 standouts. Mm-hmm. You know, it just depends on who retires when and who's right in the group and so on and so forth. So
Because it's interesting because this year was massive and next year I think it's going to be a little more interesting because you only have like maybe Steve Smith, who's the first 1 year guy who would be in that group.
Yeah, that's correct. It depends on whose eligibility cycle comes up.
Right.
So Bill, since a couple questions on sort of generally the same theme. Number one, we all know that there are certain players who were absolutely fantastic players, but really didn't like the media, didn't like dealing with the media. So since so many of the selectors are media, does that ever come into account where a guy who just gave them or their colleagues a hard time is less likely, not a slam dunk, but if he's questionable, are they less likely, in your opinion, to go ahead and let that guy join the club?
I haven't seen any evidence of that. And in fact, Terrell Owens is probably the proof that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm. And what about off-field stuff? For example, Paul Hornung got in despite the suspension. Would Adrian Peterson, who you mentioned, would the corporal punishment of his kid be something you think would in any way, or is it what you did on the field is what you did on the field?
The bylaws state that you are to be judged by what you did on the field. Paul Hornung got in. Alex Karras, who was found guilty of the very same offense and was not recalcitrant, was not repentant at the time, only got in as a member of the Centennial class. And I was a selector as part of the Centennial class, and actually one of the people, along with Bill Belichick and Ron Wolf, who did a lot of film study of the so-called old timers, and to both, I think it's fair to say, both Bills, right, thought that Alex Karras was very, very deserving as a player. He was an athletic pass rusher before those people existed. Yeah. He was the first of his kind, and he was amazing. Dominant doing that on the film, and the issue of his suspension came up in passing, but got really no consideration. Just hey, this guy's a great player, that's what we're here to do, you know, vote and he was chosen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
Hey, Bill, how much more difficult is the conversation with positions that the statistics aren't as readily obvious or collected as much? Say, for example, offensive linemen or special teams right. players. How hard are those conversations and how subjective are they?
Well, there are no special teams players in, which is a terrible tragedy, and it breaks my heart because Steve Tasker is certainly the best in my over 50 years of following pro football in that category, and he belongs in. But apparently the voters don't believe that that's a category that should be honored. His name did not come up last year, or did not come up, for any serious consideration last year. And I think the senior committee will give him, if he's to get his just desserts, which he deserves, it'll be through the senior committee. Kickers traditionally are not, and punters are not, looked upon favorably. Ray Guy was a bit of a tussle to get him in. I was one of the people that strongly supported him.
Mm-hmm.
As we know, Morten Andersen is in, Jan Stenerud is in, and I'm certain that Adam Vinatieri will be because he's the leading kicker of all time. I can think of a couple of more that I would include, but I think it's fair to say the voters don't look overly kindly on those positions. As regards offensive, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, just one other sort of special team. Just like, do you think the trend will start to look different? Like, let's say Vinatieri gets in, you'll have three kickers in. Could that be like a precursor for players like Steve Tasker or some of these guys like Brian Mitchell or Darren Sproles, who have racked up tons and tons of all-purpose yards, or somebody like Devin Hester, who, you know this very well from the Super Bowl, who could potentially change a game at a moment's notice, who leads the league in all-time sort of non-offensive touchdowns. If those guys will get a deeper look, you think?
I do. Absolutely do. The game has changed so dramatically. Since the 90s, that I'm certain they're gonna be looked upon differently.
Yeah.
Certainly, first of all, the selectors, through God's will, are gonna get younger.
Right.
and they're gonna be more amenable.
Right.
To understanding the contributions that guys like that meant. Now, Tasker and Brian Mitchell have a little harder time because many of the selectors don't remember them or remember them fleetingly. But, Devin Hester certainly is going to get serious consideration. He was an incredible weapon.
Yeah.
One of the reasons Gale Sayers, even though the short career, people who were part of the process told me that, one of the reasons Gale Sayers got in was because, he was such a dominant kickoff returner when there were no people mm-hmm. who did that to any great degree in the game. There was only one, Gale Sayers.
Yeah. Right.
So even though the short career, the injury shortened career, mitigated against him, the fact that he was so dominant as a kickoff returner was acknowledged.
Yeah.
Because we've never talked about it on the show, but I'm sure we'll get to it. Like, how high did your agita level raise when Hester returned that kickoff for a touchdown in the Super Bowl?
Well, I'm gonna give you a scoop. Vic Carucci and I have a book coming out, which will be out on November 16th, called Super Bowl Blueprint. And in the book, we study the dominant, not the, but dominant teams in a number of decades, starting with the original Raiders because of the imprint that Al Davis had on the league and all the great Raider players and coaches. And then the Steel Curtain Steelers. And then the dominant teams in the 80s and 90s i.e. San Francisco, the Jimmy Johnson Dallas Cowboys, and the Green Bay, the Ron Wolf, Mike Holmgren, Green Bay Packers, and the Joe Gibbs Redskins. And then we bring in, really because of something Phil Simms, this is an oral history, by the way. This is not Vic and I writing. It is Vic and I speaking to the players, coaches, and general managers, and in some cases owners of these teams, to get their recollections of what life was like in the NFL at the time and what it was to be on those teams. And there are some amazing, amazing anecdotes that I had never heard before and Vic had never heard before. And if we haven't heard them, probably very few people have. So it's going to be amazing. We had such fun doing it. But in it, let me backtrack. The question was, should we consider the 2000 Colts? And we said, well, we can't consider the Colts unless we consider the Patriots because it's such a rivalry. But the key components for the Patriots, Coach Belichick and Brady, are still playing. So they're not going to do interviews and retrospectives. So we couldn't include them. And we decided, well, let's not do the Colts then because it kind of looks self-serving. Obviously, I'm part of that. And Tony Dungy's part of that. Tony Dungy's a very big part of the Steelers story. But then Phil Simms said to us, you know, Peyton Manning changed how quarterback was played across the game of football, from Little League to the National Football League. And we said, holy mackerel, that's right. He did, because the game is now played by the quarterback at the line of scrimmage. And so we said, let's do it. Let's include it.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the 90s Bills in there because they were the dominant AFC team at the time. It exceeded the Steelers and, of course, four Super Bowls and the no-huddle offense. Part of it is that we found that each team that we studied had a charismatic coach. His personality didn't matter. He had a unique talent for leadership, a really good general manager to put it together, but he was far less important than the coach. And a coach with a system of football that was unique to the time. So that's the premise of the book. That's the lead-in, so you understand the anecdote. And in the book, I talk about, and others talk about, the opening kickoff of the Super Bowl between the Bills and the Bears, and Devin Hester back there. And so the day before the game at practice, I said to Tony, are we going to kick to Hester? He said, nah, no way. No,
right.
So now it's raining cats and dogs. It's been raining all day. And I'm literally up to my ankles in water in the lean-to that I'm seated in with our staff, with our front office staff on the top deck of the Orange Bowl. And we line up to kick off. And one of the guys said, boy, I hope Vinny kicks this thing out of the end zone. If he doesn't, he can kick a ground ball and it'll be mired in the mud anyway. So we kick off and Hester fields it. And it's fieldable. And, of course, he took it back.
Oh.
So I said, my God, what happened? So after the game, I asked Tony, hours after the game, I asked Tony, I said, what happened? Why? He said, well, you know, the guys are going, kick it to him, we'll stop him. He said, I decided to do it. I said, well, thank God you didn't do it again. He said, I wasn't done. There was no way it was going to happen.
Yeah. You know, let me I also have a feeling the first two words out of your mouth were slightly different than what you actually said, Bill. But that's that aside when it happened. You know, get two things. Sayers, to me, you know, just, Bill, the aesthetics of watching Sayers run were so amazing. I you know, were I a selector, I would have voted for him. Just to me, he was like the Baryshnikov of running backs, you know. It was different than anyone else I ever saw. But relative to kickers, as you've said so many times on the show, you can't win a championship without kickers. I mean, you're saying, I guess it's time that they realize, yeah, they may not be out there pounding people, et cetera, but their contribution to the team and to victory is essential. So, I mean, shouldn't more kickers be getting in there?
Well, I think when you look at it, you have to say, at least this is my point of view, contribution to victory has to be there. Longevity has to be there. High rate of success has to be there. And so, you know, that's all Vinatieri. That's all Vinny. And you know, there'll be no argument over that. That's true of Morton. And it's true of Jan, who was also a pioneer.
Yeah.
You know, foreign born, side saddle, etc. I had the good fortune of being with him for a year at Kansas City, and we're still good friends. So, you know, the outstanding people, the hall is Peter King, I think, coined this phrase. The hall is for extraordinary, outstanding people. It's not the hall of the good. It's the hall of the great and the et cetera. And so if you apply that to kickers, that Vinny's a no-brainer. And there are probably a few more that you could kind of squeeze into that category, but not many. In terms of aesthetics, you're correct about Gail Sayers' running style, which he described as herky-jerky. It wasn't. We would not describe it as herky-jerky. We would describe it as Baryshnikov-like. It was is mesmerizing in its beauty. But Megatron, that was a big consideration with Megatron. Yeah, the career wasn't as long as some others. But, man, those catches were incredible.
Yeah.
You know, he did things that no one else at his time in the league could do. And that's a very fair assessment. No mm-hmm. one argues that. Mm-hmm.
How tough is that conversation for you and Coach Dungy being in the room, and you've got guys at that position who you know are going to get in at some point with Reggie, but there's just going to be somebody in front of him this year? Because obviously you got to think Reggie will get in next year with the way the class is shaping up. But is that tough for you guys?
Yeah.
Is that a tough conversation for you guys?
No. I think you're there to give an honest opinion.
Right.
And the honest opinion in Reggie's case is glowing. In Tony Pacelli's case, it's glowing. In John Lynch's case, it's glowing. That's what we're there to do. Well. And so, you know, it's not hard. It's tough not to, you know, when they don't make it. I mean, you're disappointed, but you know, you do the best you can and be as honest as you can. Well. If you're partisan, you know, everybody loves their own guys. I mean, that's a given. And that's true of writers too.
Yeah.
I mean, they love the guys they follow. That's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, if you're overly partisan or you're overly negative in order to knock people down, that to me is a no-no. But I didn't see any of that at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're probably lucky that Bob Sanders didn't play longer or stay healthier, because that might have been a tougher conversation for you.
Had he stayed, I think someone brought that up. It wasn't Tony or I, brought it up in the context of John Lynch.
Yeah.
Did he have the same effect in Tampa Bay as Bob Sanders did? And the answer was yes. And if Bob's injuries had not gotten in the way, we'd probably be talking about him in the same vein as Troy Polamalu, who was eminently deserving of selection.
Yeah,
exactly.
And yeah.
All right. Well, I think we've successfully navigated the sort of Hall of Fame process. In the coming weeks, we're going to take a look at some of the careers of some of the Hall of Fame players that Bill had the chance to be around in his time with the Bills and the Colts, but wanted to close the loop on something that came up last week. Bill gave me a homework assignment, and I did a little bit of research over the weekend, and I found a big theme. No matter who you are as a quarterback in the NFL, playing your rookie year is pretty hard. So I went back to 1960 and looked at all of the sort of quarterback ratings that were subpar in any given year and came back with a list of about 20 candidates who could be our candidate for the sort of Mendoza line of seasonal quarterback play. And what was interesting was that there were two names that sort of came up and two distinction points. So if we were going to have it be where the player had under 250 passes, believe it or not, Terry Bradshaw's 1970 season with the Steelers would have come in as the worst rated single season a quarterback's had, according to rating, in the history of the league for at least having more than 215 total passes. If the line for us was going to be north of 300 passes, Steve DeBerg's season with the 49ers, I think in 1978, would have come in at a 40 rating. But what's interesting, Bill, is sort of in the kismet nature of having the chance to take a look at your career, that Buffalo team in 85 with Ferragamo and Matheson had some tough quarterback ratings. And a certain year in 98 where you had to make a really interesting quarterback decision is the only year statistically I could find where three quarterbacks with north of 200 passes had quarterback ratings sub 50 with Craig Whelan, Bobby Hoying, and a certain quarterback named Leaf who you decided not to draft in the 98 draft. So we got candidates. It's kind of looking to me like the line might be the Bradshaw line.
The Bradshaw line.
Well, I disagree, but only marginal.
Okay.
Because the Mendoza line indicates a professional player. But Mendoza never, he hit 215, as Rick pointed out, for his career. So he was a marginal contributor throughout his career. Terry Bradshaw, after his rookie year,
pretty good,
went on to be a Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
So even though his QBR for that year was 30.4, which is the lowest among all of the 23 people you study, I would nominate, because Terry is, as a Hall of Famer, is ineligible. You can't right. Name.
I agree with that.
Right.
Yeah, I feel like you can't.
At some point, you overcome.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that takes us to Gary Morangi.
All right, here we go.
Interestingly enough, with the Buffalo Bills, with a quarterback rating of 30.8, Terry was 30.4. So it's only 4/100 of a point differential. So I think we're all feel pretty good about calling it the Morangi line.
Yeah.
Hey, and it's got a nice sort of alliterative quality with the Mendoza line.
Exactly. That's just what I was going to say. That may be another criteria if we ever do this, you know, in any other way. It's got to start with an M.
So Twitter, go forth and start calling it the Morangi line, if you will. Interestingly enough,
Gary Morangi, by the way, was a decent quarterback. He was a decent quarterback.
Speaking of that 70s. Oh, sorry, Bill.
No, go ahead.
Well, what the other weird stat in that 76 season was Joe Namath had a really bad year in 76.
Yes, he did.
Yes,
he did. 39.9.
So yeah. My takeaway is some pretty good quarterbacks can have a couple bad years from time to time, especially early in the career. Sure. So fans, be patient.
That's right.
Indeed, be patient.
Right. Believe in your quarterbacks.
Unless you were drafting quarterbacks in 98, which there was only one obvious person to take, and Bill happened to take it. But whatever. I mean, that's fine. Fine. It's good. Because this would be a very different podcast if we gone with Bobby Hoying instead of Peyton Manning. Any question?
There are a lot of people who now have amnesia who were part of that process.
Right. That's right.
Yeah. All right, gang. Well, that was a really fun episode. Thank you, guys. And as always, it's a good suggestion. Maybe mask up and get vaccinated.
Yeah. Shopping for skincare is frustrating. Buy it, try it, toss it, repeat. Curology is here to help. Curology pairs with your own licensed dermatology provider who assesses your skin and prescribes you a custom formula to tackle acne, dark spots, or even fine lines. No guesswork, just a formula made to work for you. Get your consultation today at Curology.com/SXM. Curology, skincare with a face. Subject to consultation, subscription required. Cancel anytime.
Get ultimate protection and durability for your painting project at Menards. Get a paint that combines durability and gorgeous color. Dutch Boy's DuraClean Interior Paint and Primer in 1 offers Stay Clean technology, making your home stay beautiful and clean longer. And with Dutch Boy's easy opening smooth pouring container, transforming your home has never been easier. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and head into Menards to get your paint project started today.
Save big money.